Can you give me some background information, your names, ages, date of birth, and place of birth?
My name is Alyssa Bennett Smith. I was born on August 18th, 1988 in Naperville, Illinois, just right outside Chicago.
My name is Joshua Smith. I was born in Oklahoma City on March 1st, 1988, and is that it? We've lived in and out of communities for, well, at least as long as we've been married. A little bit longer.
Yeah. How long have y'all been married?
It was 4 years in May.
Did you do any schooling after high school, or?
Yeah, I have a bachelor's degree, or a Bachelor's of Fine Arts in Graphic Design and Illustration, and I'm currently working on a Master's degree in Theological Studies with an emphasis in Peace and Reconciliation Studies and Feminist Theology.
Cool. I got a Bachelor of Arts degree in English with a writing emphasis, and then just graduated a couple months ago with my Master of Arts in Theological Studies with an emphasis in New Testament Biblical Studies.
Okay. So a couple questions about faith in your childhood. So what faith traditions were you raised in? Or would you say you were raised in religious families? Or?
I definitely was. I was raised in sort of a non-denominational evangelical tradition, non-tradition, I guess. Mm-hmm. Until I went to college, my parents are both very devout religious folk.
Evangelical.
They were both raised in the church. My mom grew up in mega churches, and so that's kind of the churches that we went to when I was a kid. Really contemporary. I didn't use a hymnal until I went to college, kind of thing, like praise bandy stuff. And pretty fundamentalist Calvinist theology up until I went to college, and then I sort of developed my own thing, but that was childhood for the most part.
My great grandpa on my mother's side was a Methodist minister, and he and my great grandma were very religious, but they died when I was very, very young. None of the rest of my family is religious. And when I was a kid, I started hanging out at the local United Methodist Church because I grew up in a really small town, and there's nothing to do. You could go smoke cigarettes behind the factory after elementary school, or you could go up the hill and hang out, and they'd give you free food at the Methodist Church. So, and so I hung out there when I was a kid, and developed just kind of a religious curiosity. Something that sometimes I wish that I could turn off. But to this day, Mom and Dad, like, they look at me and they're like, I don't know. I don't know where it gets it. It kind of confuses them, I think.
Okay, interesting. So this was a question I had, but it only pertains to you. So mm-hmm. Since you said what you believe sort of differs from what your family raised you up with, what led you to that shift?
When I was a senior in high school, I started dating a guy who had not been raised religious, but sort of ended up in the church, and started reading authors like Rob Bell and Donald Miller, and getting more into I guess they'd call that the emerging church at the time, in like 2007, and Christian mysticism and that kind of thing, and so I started reading all that stuff too, and then when I went to college, I continued dating that guy, and we got involved with the Baptist Student Center on campus, which is where I met Josh, actually, and that community, it was small, there were, I don't know, less than 20 of us that hung out there on a regular basis. It was just very open to questioning and developing your own ideas and not necessarily, everyone didn't have to agree.
Yeah.
And I also happened to, my freshman year of college was also an election year, and so it's sort of being of age to vote in a presidential election for the first time also caused me to sort of question what I thought about a lot of things, mm-hmm. and so it just sort of naturally overflowed into theology and church and religion and community and all of that good stuff, too. I actually remember having a conversation at one point with, it was either my boyfriend or my roommate, and I said, like, I'm so tired of having to decide what I think about everything, because it just seemed like it was a solid 2 years of that, pretty much. But, it sort of started in high school with being introduced to the fact that there were different ideas, because growing up the way I did, I was never really exposed to people that believed differently than me, unless you counted, like, Catholics versus Protestants,
right.
which, in a lot of ways, really aren't that different. Being exposed to all of that and starting to read and learn and having that forum for open discussion with peers who, in a lot of ways, were more educated than me was really a healthy environment for me to do that and kind of led to me developing my own ideas.
Okay. So is that where you first started thinking about Christian intentional community?
Yes. I was introduced to the concept, I think, when I was, like, 20, and then shortly after that, Joshua and I started dating, and he gave me the book, Jesus for President, and introduced me to Shane Claiborne, and I read that book, and then the summer after my sophomore year of college, I took an internship in Washington, D.C., where I worked with a church out there, and as a part of that internship, I lived in an intentional community. Those were just my living conditions for that summer. I guess I would call it Christian intentional community, but there were non-believers and a Buddhist that lived there with us too, and so it was a little bit different than some that I've come to know since then, but it was just a really beautiful sort of like microcosm of what the world should be, I thought. And so I got to experience it for the first time there, and then came back and started reading what's that New Neighbor or something, that book that was written by Leroy Barber, who founded
Mission Year.
Mm-hmm. Was really it has a lot of sort of like testimonials in it of people who have gone through that program or lived in community, and then learning from my roommates that summer, and then the Baptist Student Center had apartments in it, and so in a sense it sort of functioned on some level as a intentional community,
mm-hmm.
although less so than, or less intentionally, I guess, than some other places, but that group of people and Joshua, and then that experience kind of all hit at the same time and started introducing me to those ideas.
Okay. So what about you? When did you first start thinking about Christian intentional community?
I think it started as sort of a question of what is God like, and if sort of Jesus did and said the things that he did and said,
mm-hmm.
What bearing does that have on our ethics and our practice? And
right.
I think I was maybe a freshman or sophomore in college, and an ex-girlfriend of mine gave me a copy of The Irresistible Revolution,
mm-hmm.
and I read about half of it, and then it just felt like this is Shane Claiborne. I felt like he started to repeat himself. And so I never actually finished the whole book. But the book that really, really, completely changed my life was Jesus for President, which I think his second book that he did with Chris Hogg.
Mm.
And there was just something about it that really spoke to me on a political level, on a religious level. And I was like, wow. So I started learning a little bit more about the simple way and things like that. Started spending as much time as I could. I had a naive understanding of, like, we have to help the poor. Well, you know, that's sort of a nebulous idea of helping the poor. It's also kind of maybe a little bit condescending, I think. I've learned that there are other ways to approach it since, you know, I've changed quite a bit. But that was probably my sophomore year of college. It was around the same time that I started living in a house with four other guys. We lived in this house for a year. We cooked each other dinner and hung out together a lot, and that was kind of cool. And then everybody kind of, actually, two of the guys got married, and then the remaining three couldn't afford to pay rent. So around that time, I had had we had a really rough winter. I think this was maybe in 2007, 2008, maybe around that time. We had a really rough winter, and I had several friends who lived at the Baptist Student Center in Cape Girardeau at Southwest Missouri State University, and we had, actually there was a girl there that I was dating, and I went to visit them and got snowed in. I parked my truck at the student center, and it started to ice, and by the time that I came back out, my truck had been iced in. I couldn't get my truck out, and so I ended up staying in the student center for about 2 days, 2 or 3 days, before I finally tried to walk back home. And in that time, every evening we would pull all the tables and chairs from all of the apartments in the student center. There were apartments above the student center. We'd pull all of the tables and chairs out and line them up in the hallway, and everybody would just sort of grab whatever they had in the pantries. You know, macaroni and cheese, and all, you know, TV dinners and these things like that. And we just make this great big feast, and we'd feed everybody at the student center. And that was one of the, foundational, experiences of community. And I think since then, maybe, I think it's this way with a lot of people who experience community, is that they have really similar experiences in college and spend a long time after college trying to regain that feeling, you know. Yeah. But I lived in the student center for 2 or 3 years. I can't remember if it was 2 or 3. I lived with a couple different roommates over the first couple of years, and then Alyssa and
I... 2.5 or 3.
Yeah, and then Alyssa and I got married at the student center, and she moved into the apartment. It was like I don't know, like a 300 square foot apartment or something like that.
Closet. Wow.
And and she moved in, and we lived there for about another 6 months, 6 or 8 months, and then we moved out. And that was sort of our. We actually moved from there into a coffee shop, which was kind of cool. It was actually kind of like this place. We moved up to the 3rd floor. The owners, it was in an old house. We moved up to the 3rd floor. The owners lived in, it lived on the 2nd floor, and the coffee shop was on the 1st floor. And they roasted their own coffee and things like that. And so we actually lived there for about 6 months before moving to Liberty, Missouri. Mm-hmm. Because it was a little bit close. Well, it was a lot closer to where I was going to seminary. Mm-hmm. My final year of undergrad, I was also working on. It was also my first year of seminary, mm-hmm. And so I was going to school as an undergrad in Cape Girardeau, and on the weekends commuting, like it's like a 14-hour round trip from Cape Girardeau to Shawnee.
Jeez.
Yeah, and sitting through weekend intensive classes. And then driving all the way back down, and then having like full-time undergrad classes during the week. And after a while, that got really expensive and really exhausting. And so we moved up to Liberty.
Well, and I started too. So it just didn't make sense to stay there.
Yeah, it was a pretty tough time. But we moved up to Liberty, and that's where we moved into kind of a small. It was an experiment. I guess we can call it an intentional community.
It was a community. We just didn't cohabitate. There were two married couples and a single woman that lived in a house together. And then we lived in a house. And then there was another couple that lived in another house. And we were all within, I don't know, like 3 blocks of each other, maybe. And then there were a few people that would come and participate from a little bit further away. But we would have, you know, weekly meals together and prayer, and we gardened together and would do things like that, but it wasn't as high commitment or as intentional as probably we would have liked, and some others in the community too, but just certain situations didn't allow for anything sort of beyond what we did.
Right.
Actually, I forgot to talk about Anava House. That was when we first got married, we decided together that sort of what we wanted to do, like our dream as a couple, was to found an intentional community. And we actually visited
Lotus.
We visited Lotus House in St. Louis. We visited in Charlotte.
Heights,
the Heights community. Actually, I don't think Jason lives there anymore.
In Charlotte, North Carolina.
How'd you pick that one to visit?
We were
there for a conference.
Yeah, we were involved in the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship for several years because they were affiliated, the Baptist Student Center at SEMO was affiliated with the CBF, which was a more moderate offshoot of the Southern Baptist that left after the
fundamentalist CBF,
the CBF Baptists call it the fundamentalist takeover of the Southern Baptists, because the Southern Baptists used to be much more moderate.
Right.
Anyway, they have a conference every year, or a convention, I guess, every year, and it moves around from city to city. And this was it 2010?
2010, yeah. It was 3 weeks after we got married.
It was in Charlotte.
We carpooled out there with a group of people from Missouri. And they had sort of like a college retreat that aligned with the convention, and so we went to that, and a part of it was focused on intentional community.
Right.
And so a part of it was we went and spent a day with High Eights, and I think we did projects with them.
We worked with them.
And learned about their structure and all of that, and why they chose the neighborhood they did, and sort of their history. They've been there for a while now. It started with two married couples that graduated seminary at the same time and decided to kind of go out and do that. And so it was kind of funny because we had been, learning about and to various degrees living in intentional community for probably about a year at that point. And we went with this group of people who were very excited about it, but didn't know much about it. They'd be, starting conversations with, "Have you heard of Shane Claiborne?" And we're like, "Yeah, read his book 2 years ago." So it was kind of interesting I don't want to say we didn't get much out of it, because it was great to go and learn from High Eights directly, but as sort of an intellectual exercise, it was a lot of stuff that we already knew.
I think it was really the first time that we saw stuff that we had read about in our little town in southeast Missouri. We actually saw it put into practice in a larger city, because you just don't see very many intentional communities in southeast Missouri.
Right. Or any.
And so we came back from that. We'd actually developed a relationship with some folks from a community in St. Louis called Lotus House, which is, they're really fascinating folks. Like, there are several people there who are like PhD students in theology and studied. I know my friend Alden studied theology at like Princeton. Yeah. This.
They bought a house together.
They bought this house in downtown
near Forest
St. Louis
Park
and put in a chicken coop and a bunch of gardens, and they've been there for years.
Are they still there?
Yeah.
I'm going to St. Louis this weekend.
Yes.
Actually,
look them up.
At least drive by.
They are wonderful folks.
They're on Lotus. That's why they're called
that. Yeah, that's
why they're called Lotus. That makes it easy to get.
Yeah.
And so we developed a relationship with them and sort of seeing all of these different places, seeing how it worked in places, we thought we could do this in, you know, our little college town in southeast Missouri because, you know, even though it's not a very large city, you can still see the need. Like, there's still a sort of, you know, I hate to make it sound this way, but there's still sort of like a poorer part of town, you know, the wrong side of the tracks or whatever, but it's being a small town, everything is much, much closer together.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, wow, you've got people who are pretty wealthy with people who are pretty poor living like right next to each other,
mm-hmm.
Which was also my experience in Alabama when Alyssa went to Washington D.C. in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
I, as part of the same program, I was sent to Marion, Alabama, which is in Perry County. It's one of the, 50 poorest counties in the United States, and it's rural, which is really interesting that she ended up in this, really dense urban area.
That was on purpose.
And I ended up in this really, obscure, out there rural town. And so it was very different experiences of poverty. And I grew up in a rural, a very poor rural town, and I lost my train of thought.
the disparity in wealth.
Oh yeah, in Cape Girardeau. So yeah, so we thought, well, we could do something like that here, and so we started working on this idea called Anava House. And Anava is a Hebrew word that means.
Love.
No,
humility.
Anava means, it means humility, but it's the kind of humility that means that, recognizes that everyone has the ability to teach everybody else.
Right.
It's like, it's a very mutual idea. It's there is humility and mutuality.
Yeah.
And,
I'm enjoying your discourse over there.
Oh, thanks.
Are you guys talking about, city planning, urban studies stuff?
Intentional communities. Intentional communities.
Ah. Okay, define that
briefly. People who live together and try to make their neighborhoods better places.
Mm-hmm. As less urbanized, right?
Yeah, sure.
I studied urban studies for a time at UPC. My major was linguistics.
Hmm. Ooh, that's tough.
It was fun. Well, it drove me literally insane. But yes. Anyway, continue.
Oh, okay.
Thank you very much.
So we came up with this idea for Anava House, and I don't know if we... It's like a lot of things that we've come up with. We've had a lot of ideas that we've come up with in the last few years that just maybe are really good ideas, great ideas, but just don't have the support or maybe the technical know-how to put them into practice.
Right.
We actually went pretty far with Anava House without actually having anybody.
We made a lot of progress with people.
It was just the two of us, and at the time we were kind of wavering between whether or not we were going to remain rooted in Cape Girardeau or if we were going to move to Kansas City. So it was kind of like, well, here we have this idea for a model intentional community that could be in Cape Girardeau, could be in Kansas City.
Well, and at the time we were living in that coffee shop and working at it, and the owners were trying to sell it. And so we had this grand scheme that we would raise the money and buy the business and the house and build a community in that house because it was a really great, logistically, it was a really great setup for that. As 22-year-old college students, we were like, sure, we can raise $500,000. That's no problem. We'll do that. And obviously that was not as easily done as we anticipated.
Not successful at all.
Well, good to dream big, though.
Yeah, I mean, we... Real big. Yeah. We were...
Well, but we, I mean, we'd actually, we'd put together like a sort of a vision and a mission statement.
And we had like a 1, 3, and 5 year plan. And
yeah.
Put together all, we like petitioned
basically,
churches for support.
The only thing we lacked were people and money. Which is like, well,
they're a little important.
You kind of need those things. And there was just not, there was not enough human interest in Cape Girardeau.
Why do you think that is? Did you just not have enough contacts up there, or
I think
not the right time?
I think it was kind of a mixture of a lot of things. There were people that were interested, but not in the level that they would be willing to commit, which is a side effect of being in college, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, we were, what, 22, 23 at the time, and so all of our friends were that age as well, or a little older or younger. And, you know, in the stage of life where they were in a position to make sort of decisions about their future, and so they could have committed, and so they were willing to have discussions about it with us, but when it came down to it, it was a lot of, like, kind of wishy-washy feelings about it. And honestly, like, not many people who go to school in Cape Girardeau want to stay in Cape Girardeau.
Yeah.
So the idea of committing to, you know, a certain number of years staying in that place is not attractive to someone who basically has, like, the whole world in front of them at the time. So, I mean, we did have a lot of people who were willing to help with it, but not very many people who were willing to commit to living there, which is what we really needed at the time to sort of move forward with it.
And I mean, looking back, it was kind of an idealistic and naive way to go about starting community. Although, like, it's like, you know, our friends...
We didn't know any other way to do it.
Yeah, well, our friends at Lotus House...
that's how they did it.
They went to church together, and they were in, like, a Sunday school class, and they read
Irresistible
Revolution together, and they were like, oh, we could do that.
Yeah.
And so they just did. They maxed out some credit cards or something like that. I don't know. And they bought a friggin' house. And they're still there. You know, that's it's just some neighborhoods and communities are.
Well, and they have had, you know, in that example, they have had people sort of cycle in and out of it. It's not the exact same members that moved in, although there are sort of the core, what, like 4 or 5 that have been there since the beginning. But it just wasn't the right time for it in Cape, and certainly wasn't, and from a financial standpoint, wasn't something that was really doable without more people involved.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, churches backing, or, and I don't know that was something we could have found in Cape Girardeau. The religious climate in Southeast Missouri, being sort of like the buckle of the Bible Belt, is not so open-minded sometimes, and so...
Right.
Yeah, so when you say, we want to start an intentional community...
Yeah,
like,
I mean,
there were
maybe a couple of churches that could have gotten on board with something like that, but, you know, in the grand scheme of things, they would have like, what are y'all, a bunch of hippies?
Hippie commune?
So, I don't know that it would have gone over so well, although, I mean, I'm sure... They're all over the country, so I'm sure it's doable regardless of that, depending on the model. But
yeah, which is
the kind of support we needed just wasn't there.
We didn't really realize at the time either, like, because I think there's sort of an image of intentional communities that they're sort of notorious for not communicating with one another. They all sort of do their own thing. They're isolated in their neighborhood, and so, like, I remember thinking, oh, we're gonna be like the first intentional community in the Midwest.
There aren't any out here.
Yeah, there's nothing out here. And then just sort of realizing, like, wait, there's sort of this underground network of people who, like, I know somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody on all of these communities. I mean, the place is full of communities.
And that's, like, case in point was after that fell through, we ultimately decided to move to Kansas City to be closer to the seminary while we were in school, and we looked into intentional communities in Kansas City, and the only one we could find before we moved up here was Cherith Brook.
Oh, yeah.
Because they were the only one with any kind of online presence, and that was our only resource at the time. And so I think we kind of talked to them a little bit, but never really seriously about moving in or anything, because we... situation just worked out better for us to move up to Liberty. That's where all of our friends were and where a house was that we could move into. But, you know, come to find out now that there's probably almost a dozen in Kansas yeah. City alone, but we didn't know about any of them before we came up here. So that's just, like, one example of one city that's like that. We were like, well, there's only one in Kansas City. Maybe we could start another one. And there's, yeah. you know, come up here and start meeting people and find out that there's...
Before we moved up here, we sent about 30 or 40 letters to different churches in the area. And, I mean, these are just sent out letters. We didn't know anybody. We didn't know any churches. We just thought, this seems like a church that, you know, we Googled churches in Kansas City that they seem like they might be amenable to helping sponsor an intentional community. And so we like sent letters to all these churches saying, hey, would you help us start this intentional community? And not surprisingly, we didn't hear back from any.
One of which is our church now.
Yeah, yeah, actually. It was kind of a strange twist of fate. We sent a letter to this church. And then, like, 3 years later, ended up
members
moving
there.
Just half a mile from there, and now we're members there. But, yeah, and then, so we moved to Liberty, and then we spent about a year in a low-commitment intentional community. I think that might be the best way of putting it. That everybody sort of had their own lives. We weren't really together for any sort of grand purpose except to be together.
Yeah, there wasn't an outward focus like you find in a lot of higher commitment communities where they have, you know, like with Cherith Book, they have a really strong commitment to the homeless in their community, or, you know, urban farming or that kind of thing. We were all just, I think we all went to the same church.
Most of us, yeah.
those of us that went to church went to the same church. And we all lived close together, and a lot, we knew each other. Like, we moved to Liberty because our best friends from college were in Liberty, and they had best friends from the other college they went to that moved in, and friends that they had met since moving to Liberty. So we all knew each other beforehand. And so we figured, well, if we're going to live close to one another, we might as well give this a try. And sometimes it worked better than others, but...
It was sort of our first real experience, and I hate to even call it a real experience of community, because that implies that everything that we experienced before that wasn't real, but it was our first experience of like, oh, this is really friggin' hard.
Really hard. Yeah. Especially when you have, I mean, the grand total participants in that community was probably between 10 and 15, and when you have that many people who, like he said, like, live their own lives and have different ideas of kind of why they're there and what they're after, it really complicates things. And then, you know, we sort of came together in the summer of 2011, and then that Thanksgiving, our best friends who were in the community with us told everyone they were pregnant with their first child. And very shortly after that, we found out that the other married couple that lived in their house had been accepted to grad school in another city, so they were going to be moving around the same time the baby was born. It just kind of, it almost started to fall apart before it even came together, because we knew the expiration date for it. We knew that, you know, this couple was about to have their first baby, and I think they intended to step away from community until they could sort of figure out their lives as parents, and then kind of reassess if that was something they wanted to do. And then, you know, the other couple was going to be going off to grad school, and several of the rest of us were already in grad school. And so, you know, we had maybe 4 months of full head-on, full steam ahead kind of attitude. And then after that, it was like, well, this is only until August kind of thing. So it was weird in that way, too, where we didn't really have a significant amount of time where everybody was fully dedicated to it, because we could see the finish line almost as soon as we started. So But it was, I think it was a really good experience for everybody. We got to learn what conflict was like in community and good ways to deal with that, and what it feels like when different people in the community have different expectations of the community, or different commitment levels, even we didn't get to participate in this part of it, but there were five people that did live in the same house, and so it was almost like a little community within a community, and so they got to experience cohabitation and, you know, sort of a common purse idea and, you know, what it is to live in
common
same
chores.
Space with everyone. And so I think we got, like, little tastes of everything, although we never really got the full experience that we were looking for, at least.
I will say that particular time was one of the hardest times in my life that I've experienced, hardest times on my faith. It was really, really, it was a really difficult time as I felt a lot of my assumptions challenged, even assumptions about what it meant to live in a community and what it meant to, what it meant to be socially and ethically active. And, and I think around the time that community dissolved was around the time that I would probably around that time have identified as an atheist, and which is like, you have this really some sort of existential issues going on that I'm actually still working through, but when the community dissolved, the immediate result of that was that I actually changed degree programs. I was in an MDiv program, and I changed to the MA, the Master of Arts in Theological Studies, which was a more research-based academic degree. I actually kind of threw myself into my studies, and became more of a... that was like when I actually became a student. I've been in seminary for 2 years before I actually became a student. And so for the last 2 years, I've been, like, doing research, and I haven't spent a whole lot of time, like, actively seeking community.
Right.
And instead, for a while now, I've been trying to find ways that I could fit into existing communities without necessarily feeling the need to move in to them, you know? And my emphasis is in New Testament literature, and I'd like to teach biblical studies at a university. But I also thought that there's some part of me that has sort of carried this community thing along with me this whole time, that I think that one of these days I could live in a community and I could be, like, an academic voice within the community, in an intentional community, but also be a voice and an advocate for intentional communal living in an academic setting, too.
Right.
So, like, be that voice that sort of bridges the gap between the two. I mean, that's a very, I think, romanticized view of what it is. I'm still kind of feeling out what that means. And, you know, I don't know if I'll ever get there, but so for the last few years, my life has revolved less around community and more around my studies, which just creates problems all in its own since I'm graduated now. But, and so I'm sitting around twiddling my thumbs. But it was shortly after the community dissolved that Alyssa and I, we ran into all sorts of financial difficulties because of job situations, and I was working for AmeriCorps at the time, and ultimately what happened was we ended up having to move out of the house that we lived in Liberty because we couldn't afford to live there anymore, and so we moved to Kansas City, Kansas, and we've lived there for 2 years, just the two of us.
When you guys mentioned when you sat down and you were making your plans and you had your mission statement, I guess in your minds, what is an ideal community for you? Like, what would be, can you tell me a little bit more about what your mission statement was, or like, what you ideally envision yourself being part of?
Well, at that time,
or like, if that's different,
3.5 years ago, it was it was probably more focused on, like a contemplative lifestyle or new monasticism. Went through a phase where you like kind of wanted to be a monk for a minute.
It's hard to be a monk when you're married.
It is. And so there was a lot in the original for Anna the House. There was a lot of talk of common prayer and common study in general, really, of the Bible and liturgy. And we had dreams of common work, too, where, I mean, at the time with the coffee house, we had planned that just whoever lived in the community would work in the coffee house, and that would be the revenue generator, that kind of thing.
Well, and I was really into ceramics.
Yes.
I do pottery. And oh, we could get some pottery wheels in here, teach some neighborhood kids, have little workshops for the
There
kids.
Was a little outbuilding, like a little cottage next to the house the coffee
kitchen,
shop was
I think,
in.
Right?
Yeah, and so we had dreams of turning that into like a ceramic studio.
Mm-hmm.
I think now, like we've talked recently about being really attracted to tiny house communities. Another couple from the community up in Liberty, they moved to Springfield to go to grad school. They had the same dream, and so we talked with them a lot about the possibility of someday, you know, buying a plot of land together, and farming or growing our own food and raising animals and living in separate tiny houses, but having a house in the sort of the center that was like a common space for things like the library and a large kitchen and eating area for guest meals and like space for people to come stay and
hospitality.
Sort of like everything but your private living space would kind of be in that center common area. And I think we're still attracted to the idea of common prayer and a lot of the new monastic ideas. But probably not as strongly as we were maybe 3 years ago.
I mean, I would say I've still got, it's been kind of a slow burn passion of mine. And actually, just as a side note, the couple that moved to Springfield, my friend Jay, who is, they both just graduated.
Yeah, they're done.
He was a communications, he was getting his master's in communications and wrote his thesis on conflict resolution in intentional communities.
Yeah.
I have not read it yet. Maybe
I bet
I could
it's
get
great.
A copy of it for and he visited the Dancing Rabbit Eco Village. But to go back to the how I got interested in new monasticism, I'd completely forgotten about that. My very first class in seminary was,
creativity and spirituality.
Yeah, I had been interested in new monasticism for a while. Like, I was aware of Shane Claiborne and Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove and the 12 Marks of New Monasticism that sort of came out of Rook the House. And I think I had that book at the time as well. But my very first class in seminary was held at a monastery. And it was I spent a weekend staying at Conception Abbey in northwest Missouri. It's Benedictine Abbey, and I thought, wow, like, and I remember it was about a 2-hour drive up there or something like that, and on the way back, I remember thinking, wow, would it be cool if you could, like, buy, like, an old burned-out church or something, and then have an intentional community in that, like, have people that, like, you could convert the classrooms into bedrooms or whatever, and then you'd have, like, the church sanctuary, you could actually have, like, a communal a worship space for creative, you know, creative worship, things like that.
And then 6 months later, we met a community that did that.
Which was actually fascinating.
In Kansas City.
Our friends at Oak Park, like, that's exactly what they did. Well, they, I mean...
It was a functioning church, second story wasn't being used, and so they moved into it and turned it into an apartment, large apartment.
That's exactly what I wanted.
They've since very recently moved out of the church, but it was... We went and visited them, and we thought, like, this is exactly what we want.
Yeah. So, I think it's actually just listening to us. Sort of, we don't talk about this very often, but together at least. But listening to us tell this story, it's kind of made me aware of, like, how many people that we know, like how, like what a network that we have without actually being in an intentional community ourselves. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Like, hey, we know this person and this person and this person.
What happened when we left the community in Liberty was we did start looking at communities in Kansas City with the intention of maybe moving into one of them, especially Oak Park, because we bonded really quickly with the members there and became really close friends with the... At the time, there were four of them. When we first met, they were six, and then when we moved from Liberty, there were four. Ultimately, any community that functions with the level of commitment that we're looking for is going to expect the same level of commitment from any of the participants. And so, as graduate students, and with Joshua looking at possibly pursuing a PhD, we couldn't commit to being in Kansas City.
Yeah.
And so we've sort of functioned as these, like, hovering admirers of the community. And
yeah, we're intentional community groupies.
Basically. I mean, we've built friendships with a lot of people and on both the Kansas and the Missouri side through the community of communities in Kansas City, but haven't been able to actually, like, pull the trigger on moving into any of them because when it comes down to it, like, we might be moving a year from now to Texas or Denver or Boston or wherever the PhD program is, and so it's been more of a hobby, I guess, than... I mean, the friendships are real, but we haven't been able to really dedicate the amount of time to it that we would want to because of our sort of stage in life at this point.
Right.
I think early on it was, for me at least, it was a crusade. It was like, it maybe in some small way rebelling against the church that I attended when I was a kid. I went to the Methodist church and ended up being pretty active in the youth group there, even though my family wasn't very religious. I was really, really active there. I remember one time my mom grounded me from attending the Hanging of the Green service for Advent. So I was that kid, the kid that got grounded from attending church functions. I think maybe in some small way there was this little bit of edgy, like, rebellion against the quaint, good country folk, you know, religion that I had subscribed to as a teenager.
Yeah.
And so being in an intentional community felt like it was this really socially, it was this very freeing thing to take part in. And it also made me feel really like superior, right? But here was this nice white middle class boy who is saying we need to help the poor or whatever, and I think, I don't know, maybe he's still in there rattling around somewhere, but over time I think what happened was it ultimately, community grew into this, for me at least, this desire to really connect with people. And not that I'm not concerned with economic disparity and social injustice anymore, but it's just that I think over time I've realized, like, I really want to connect with other people, and I want especially our experience in Liberty made me realize that I want to find people who are as committed to me as I feel like I am to them, to be able to really know somebody. And I don't know, maybe I'll feel differently in another 5 years, but But that's sort of where it's been for me. There was another one of these grand ideas. When we were in Liberty, I tried to do... I wanted to do this thing. I think in Philadelphia they had this thing called the... Is it the People's Seminary?
What was that?
It's basically, it's like real basic theological education for free. Like they get volunteers to come in and teach seminar courses and things like that. Real grassroots, it's a grassroots seminary.
Yeah, that's what it was.
And then there was the People's Seminary and the Seminary of the Streets out on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, hey, how about the Common Ground Seminary of Greater Kansas City? Mm-hmm. So we could get people together and do these little seminars and have professors come in, but gear it toward people who maybe are not inclined to pursue a really expensive seminary education, make theology more accessible.
Right.
And that fell through as well, just lack of interest and lack of support. But all of these ideas that on of a house and People's Seminary and they're still floating around in the ether on the internet somewhere there.
We still get calls.
Yeah, we still get calls.
About on of a house. I got one 3 weeks ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I mean, at this point, we just end up connecting them to other people in Kansas City.
Forward them on to other people.
It's interesting, the people that contact you about communal living.
Mm-hmm.
There's some real interesting personalities.
Yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Actually, I had somebody contacted me a few years ago about on of a house. They were like, Dear Joshua, we would like to invite you to our community. We're a small community of King James onlyists who are waiting for the Lord to come back and the world to end. We've begun to stockpile weapons and...
Oh my, oh, very strange.
Maybe the FBI should know about you. But, we're just... we still want to be around people. And mm-hmm. It's been really hard not feeling grounded in other people as we've lived in Kansas City, Kansas, the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the people I've talked to were in communities for a very short period of time, and they just dissolve or whatever sort of conflict.
A lot of that.
And a lot of that conflict seems to come from, like what you're saying, like different ideas of what a community should be, different ideas of what the group should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them broke up because somebody became agnostic, everybody else was from different denominations, and it just wasn't, they weren't melding together.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, if you're envisioning intentional community, is everybody living in that community coming to the table with the same ideas about faith, or would you want community members who come from all different spectrums of religiosity?
Personally, I would be bored if everyone thought the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I've experienced firsthand that the conflict that can come from people, believing different things, especially when it comes to faith, because that plays such a strong role in intentional living.
Yeah.
But when the community in Liberty, the conflict that we had within that community had more to do with differing levels of commitment than differing views and faith. We had some people who were very theologically conservative, some who were theologically progressive. There was, Josh already talked a little bit about sort of his transition that happened while we were in that community, but there was another member who came into that community. I guess he calls himself an agnostic. He doesn't call himself a Christian.
That would be his story to tell.
Right, but suffice it to say that there were a lot of different ideas about a lot of different things, theologically speaking, but that never got in the way, weirdly. it was mostly about, we're trying to do common prayer and nobody's showing up. Or, we're trying to build a chicken coop and nobody wants to help, or stuff like that. It had nothing to do with what anybody thought about God. But part of my studies has been conflict mediation, and my goal, one of my goals, we'll see which one ends up happening, is to do conflict mediation and conflict transformation for intentional communities. And I don't know, as something, like, I can understand why if you're in a sort of a faith-centered community, you would want people to have sort of at least the same basic ideas of what faith is. But I think that if you're really committed to the community and to living together, and to that relationship with those people, I don't think that gets in the way as much as, you know, whose turn is it to do the dishes kind of stuff.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, on the surface, like at first glance, I would want to say, yeah, everybody come to the table. Who cares what you believe? We'll all just gather around and sing Kumbaya. But I think at the same time, I don't know. I think originally my understanding of intentional community was this is what the church is supposed to be. And I know there are other religious movements that are based around that idea. Some perhaps a little bit more well-known and established than others. Like the Watchman Nee and Witness Lee, Little Flock, Lord's Recovery Movement, I think is what they called it. They have kind of this same idea. But like originally I was like, no, this is what the church is supposed to be like. And I kind of grew out of that. I think that Christianity is a really broad umbrella. And yeah, that term applies to a lot of different ideas and different types of people. But at the same time, I can only see, like, I would be interested in Christian intention. I could see a lot of problems with, like, just ideologically when people are not sort of, you know, of the same mindset, the same, to use, like, religious terms, I guess, you know, what was it, Acts talks about these little communities, church communities, being of the same heart and mind.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know, I hate to be that guy, you know, the religious guy. But I think my preference would be to be with other people who sort of feel the same way about a lot of matters of faith that I do.
Yeah.
And I know that sounds boring, but I think there's something beautiful in that. I mean, that's what, you know, you go to a monastery and there may be different, there may be people with different nuanced understandings of the same theology, but they still have this sort of, you know, you go to Conception Abbey, and all of the monks there are going to be Roman Catholic. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so to have that framework of belief is really, like, it's a huge step forward to have that foundation. If you're going to be a part of an intentional community, to have that shared practice, that thing in common.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, that's just me. Well, this is obviously different.
I interviewed a woman last week who was telling me about her experience in Central Community. I was referencing her husband who became agnostic while living there. And their community had a practice of bringing, like, a weekly reading to prayer times. And he started bringing, like, excerpts from Marx. And it just did not. And shortly after that, they left the community because they had all, like, in hearing each other's readings that they brought to the table, they were, we don't understand each other anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was thinking about. But, all right. I have some questions about ideas of social justice in intentional community, because it seems to be such a big part of at least the majority of the communities I've talked to, like Cherith Brook and their idea of hospitality, and the homeless, or urban farming guys had their ideas about, like, I don't know, for lack of a better analogy, like teaching a man to fish, like, or teaching a man to grow his own aquaponic fish or garden or whatever. So you said that you were more interested in the idea of, like, community with people within your house. Why, or would you consider having social justice as a part of any intentional community you lived in, or why is that not as important a factor for you?
I think, like, for me, that would be important. That was actually one of, when we did live in Liberty, that was one of the main issues that the two of us had with the structure of the community up there was, we mentioned earlier, it didn't have much of an outward focus. It was mostly about the people that lived there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I would now be as sort of, like, bent on the idea of, like, you know, like, Cherith Brook has their, like, specific ministries, I guess is a good word for what, that, you know, they have shower days and they have meals and they have all these things that they do that are sort of like planned activities.
Mm-hmm.
And I can appreciate that, and I think that I would like, I would enjoy living in a community that functioned in that way.
Yeah.
But I also have a lot of admiration for communities like Lotus House, where they sort of impact the community just by existing within it.
Mm-hmm.
They've developed relationships with the people in their neighborhood, and if their neighbor can't pay their electric bill, they come to them and they can help them out. And,
right.
You know, it's not so formalized systemized in that way. It's a more natural outpouring of the relationships that they have with those people. And not to say that, you know, Cherith Brook doesn't have the relationships with the people that they help, because they absolutely do. But I'm as an introvert, it is easier for me to function within that systemized structure, but it's also easier for me to disconnect from people in that structure. And so it would be easy for me to go and live in a community that cooked a meal for people every Wednesday night or whatever. But it would be equally as easy for me to use that to sort of appease my conscience and not actually develop relationships with the people that came to the meal. And so, knowing that about myself, I'm more attracted to the idea of living in a community where I actually build those relationships, and then the service is an outpouring of that love. Because I think that's the more important part. It's the building of the larger community that I'm more interested in. But it is definitely, I think it's a natural side effect of any healthy, intentional community, which might be kind of a strong statement. But I think if you're living among people and you care about them, you're going to be taking care of them, and they're going to be taking care of you in the same way. I would say that it's important to me, certainly.
I just want to be Herman. I think I would just echo what she said. You know, we had ideas for Onaba House, and it was going to be, a year ago, there was a community of communities gathering in Kansas City, and the topic of discussion was the tension between doing and being. And I mean, you see this played out over and over and over and over again in communities, especially Christian communities. It's the tension between the active life and the contemplative life.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been a little bit more contemplative, even though I started out really active. I've been sort of moving more toward the contemplative side. But ultimately, I think there has to be a balance between the Benedictines call it the ora et labora, right? The prayer and work. They sort of recognize the need that, okay, you spend a lot of time praying the office and deep in contemplation and in Lectio Divina and things like that. But then there's also a time when work has to get done in the community. Everybody has a job, and so that informs my idea of how community should be oriented toward social justice, which has almost become kind of a cliche term, I think. That it's maybe been co-opted. I don't know. I think maybe liberation is becoming one of those social justice, liberation, things like that are becoming these code words that have been co-opted by white middle class males like me. And not that they, I mean, they don't have meaning still, but I think that anytime you talk about social justice, it has to ultimately boil down to a balance between, in communities at least, boil down to a balance between between the active life and the contemplative life. And they don't have to be mutually exclusive. The active life can draw people into the contemplative life, and the contemplative life can light a fire under people's feet to push them to be more active. Mm-hmm. I've seen both. So that's I would prefer a life of balance. Although, you know, I would like to be left alone out in the woods somewhere. That's just my preference.
So I think what I'm hearing from you, what I think I hear from other intentional community members, is that the way you improve a neighborhood or a community is not by, like, intentionally saying, these are the plans I'm going to do, I'm going to bring these people up on their feet. It's by building relationships, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
I think the former way that you mentioned that, like, it's very triumphalistic, right? Like, it's sort of the old way of, you know, the old missionary way. Like, you move into a place and say, you know, stake out your ground and say, you know, we're gonna help you whether you need it or not.
Yeah, fix you.
Yeah, we're gonna fix you.
A little paternalistic.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. It's very, and it's kind of colonialistic.
It's very colonialistic.
And I think you, I don't even feel the need to, I don't know, I think that leads into like a philosophy of missions, you know, that I don't even know, I don't have very many thoughts about it, I haven't really thought about it that much, but I do know that I would rather just be with somebody than spend all my time trying to tell them all the good things that I'm doing to help them.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. A last set of questions I have is about, like, simple living and gardening, because that seems to be an important facet of, like, Christian intentional living for a lot of groups, is that it goes hand in hand with, like, growing your own food or recycling your wastewater. Is that, you mentioned the idea of, like, living in tiny houses and sharing a garden together. So why do you is that an important part of living your faith for you?
I think that all of that, the idea of simple living appeals to me from the perspective of a person who struggles with anxiety, and just the idea of being at least somewhat kind of off the grid, for lack of a better word, and providing for yourself and having to rely less on outside sources is attractive. I'm also, I feel like sort of ecological sustainability is a natural extension of stewardship and sort of the teachings of Jesus in the Bible and the whole idea of community in general. Like, if you expand that to include the environment around you, I just think it makes sense. And just from a rational standpoint, you know, there's no sense in waste at all.
Yes.
And so
there's no sense in every person on your block each having their own lawnmower.
There just isn't. And quite honestly, I don't like gardening, but I like sustainability, and so I can tolerate gardening. It's sort of that idea. Like,
I like, you know, sewing and that, I mean...
Domestic stuff.
Yeah, domesticity and simple living. I am not a person that holds on to things. And so that comes more easily to me than the idea of going out and planting and tending to and harvesting things. I'm also just not very good at it. But, yeah, I think it's... The whole idea in general of simple living is really important to me. You know, I wouldn't want to live in a community that, well, I don't know, is in, like, some suburb somewhere and is, like, trying to make a difference among a bunch of white middle-class folk. Like, I just, it's not, I grew up in that sort of environment, and it's not, not productive, I don't think. I'm more attracted to the idea of coexisting with people and learning to provide for yourselves, through whatever. I mean, not everybody is going to be a gardener, or not everybody is going to be a sewer. I hate the word seamstress, but,
Taylor?
Sure. but I think when you come together in a group like that, there are going to be people that have different passions and different skill sets, and I think that it just makes sense to use them.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, for me, I know this sounds really cliche and cheesy, but I really think everything does, for me at least, come down to Jesus. Mm-hmm. I look at Jesus' sayings on simplicity and on in some way being... you know, Jesus was part of an agrarian society. Like, all of his imagery comes from farming, and seeing, you know, the sort of wonder at the natural world in his language, in his teachings, and how he refers to the lilies of the field and the sparrows and the birds of the air, and his use of the mustard seed imagery and things like that. So it, maybe in a romantic way, that's where that comes from for me. Because I do enjoy gardening. I think it's magic. It's like you put this little thing in the ground, add a little bit of water, sunshine, and then something grows out of it, and you can eat food off of it, you know, which is so far removed from the way we get food now. You know, just go into the supermarket. And so, I mean, and that may be a little bit of a romantic or a romanticized idea, mm-hmm. But there's something about that really appeals to me, self-sufficiency and knowing, like, you know, you go back to the creation story in Genesis, and there is supposed to be a cost of feeding ourselves. Like, we're supposed to work at it, which is really far removed from where we are now. A lot of us, we go to work, we sit at a desk and stare at a computer screen or whatever, and then we go to our supermarket and buy our food. There is an element of like a recognition in Genesis that you're going to have to work and struggle to survive.
Right.
I think we've lost sight of that in our cushy, wasteful culture. I used to work at. It really hit me when I started working at the Olive Garden a few years ago. I worked for the Olive Garden for 2 or 3 years, and I saw just how much food people threw away. And it was like as I was scraping, you know, this person's dish of all of the food that they had left on their plate, I would think about, like, oh, wow, I wonder how many people starved to death today. And sort of taking responsibility for that. But simple living has always appealed to me because I grew up in a rural context. Mm-hmm. And so, like, my grandparents always used to make their own, actually I have a grandpa right now who's really gotten into, like, making butter and cheese lately. He does his own cheese making and stuff like that. So, when I was growing up, we always canned our own food, and that was like,
years later, it's become like this pop culture thing, right? Like you see all the hipsters canning their own foods and things. Yeah, you better watch what I say.
Not the right crap.
Yeah. And I mean, this makes me sound as much a hipster as anybody, but I was doing it back before it was, before it was a cool thing to do. Just because, you know, we lived out in the country, we went out and picked blackberries and came home and made blackberry jelly. We canned our jalapenos and produce and things like that. And so maybe there's a bit of nostalgia to it as well, because I remember that when I was growing up. But I really think that anybody who wants to remain authentic and be sincere in their following of this way of life that the Jesus of the Gospels offers, they have to seriously consider adopting that lifestyle. Which to me, like, I think one of the hardest sayings that Jesus ever said was, give to everyone who asks of you, and don't expect them to pay you back. Which is like, that's crazy. That's not the way the world works. And so in a really complicated life, simplicity is countercultural, which I think is really cool, and it really appeals to me. And that's something that, even though we haven't lived in community for the last 2 years, we can still live simply. We have our, what is it my grandpa calls it? He calls it, not decadent. What is it?
I don't know.
He uses, it's basically, we have our vices here and there. We'll
indulgences?
Yeah, maybe. We have Netflix and Hulu and things like that. Praise the Lord.
We buy groceries from the store.
But I mean, we live in an 800 square foot house. We try our best to be as simple and make as much of our own things, our own needs as possible. Like I went through a phase where, Shane Claiborne did this. He was like, well, the clothing companies are evil because they're exploiting workers in third world countries. Yeah. So what we need to do is make our own clothes. Well, so I started making my own clothes for a while. And then after a while, I realized, in addition to looking ridiculous, I started thinking about, like, wait, where is this fabric made that I'm making my own clothes out of? Like, basically, I've kind of cut out the middleman, but I'm still using this fabric these textiles that are
not a whole lot better.
So eventually, I just sort of made the switch to, okay, I can buy my clothes at Goodwill and not be purchasing anything new, which is still a flawed approach, but I think it's the one that I feel most comfortable with these days.
It's really hard to completely disengage
from
the system.
Yeah, absolutely.
Without a whole community of people, one who would devote their life to, like, being at the loom.
Right.
Another who would be, like, in charge of canning. Like, it's, so I think, I would argue that acknowledging the luxuries we have is at least, like, half.
Yeah, you're halfway there.
Yeah.
If you're aware of all the ways that you're privileged, that's at least something.
Yeah.
One last question I have is, a part of the project, I'm compiling a list of resources for people who don't know anything about Christian Intentional Community to find out more about it. And I know about Shane Claiborne and Jonathan Wilson Hargrove. But that's pretty much where my knowledge ends. So if you were talking to somebody who knew nothing about Christian Central Community, at least this new wave, where would you direct them? Like, what media or books or websites would you suggest?
Well, the Mission Year, the program, is it's built around the idea of Christian Intentional Community. It's meant to be temporary.
Mm-hmm. So it's about a year, I think.
Yeah, but it's a good, I mean, just reading up on the program gives you a general idea of sort of how intentional community works.
Yeah.
That organization is run by Sean Castleberry now.
Yeah.
It's not Leroy Barber.
Yeah, he founded it, but he doesn't run it anymore. There's also The Ordinary Radicals is a...
Oh, the DVD.
Is a sort of a documentary, I guess.
Yeah.
That
it's a few years old now.
It deals with sort of intentional community, but other issues that kind of go hand in hand to do with social justice and
it's actually the
church.
It's a documentary based around the Jesus for President book tour.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like Shane Claiborne and Chris Haw and a bunch of other folks basically got in their veggie oil-powered bus and drove across the country. And the DVD is, the documentary is about the people that they encountered that they feel are living out, you know, kingdom values,
yeah,
or the values of the reign of God.
Mm-hmm.
That's Jean Vanier is another really good source. He's the founder of the Larche communities that are specifically oriented toward people who have mental and physical disabilities. And he wrote a book called Community and Growth. Is that the...
I think so.
Something like that. And it's basically, it's very grassroots sort of like broken people, helping broken people kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
which really is like theologically, for me at least, like I just, maybe this has just been on my mind since I just graduated, but in my ecclesiology, in my final section of my final theology paper for seminary, I referred to the church as the family of God broken open before the world, and I see that's what communities are supposed to be, the family of God broken open for the world and before each other.
Right.
And I really see, Jean Vanier has been really influential in my own understanding of how communities should function.
The Catholic worker movement, too,
yeah,
like Dorothy Day, Life Together, was that Bonhoeffer?
Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
What are those two books that Jay introduced us to that we bought?
Those are, I can't remember the title. The author is,
it's
Smith.
A woman.
Yeah, her name's Smith, something Smith.
But that'll help.
It's not, that's not particularly Christian.
They're not, it's not specific to Christian intentional community, but they're all about living together.
The Intentional Christian Community Handbook.
Mm-hmm. David Jansen,
right? Gosh, it's so hard to think of them all off the top of my head. I could send you a list. I just have like shelves full.
Yes, if you think of any later or anything, just email me. That'd be so helpful.
I could also email you, you know, like I said, all of those, you know, wide-eyed plans that we had.
We still have all that.
We still have all of that. So like
really?
All of our, all of the information, like, here is what Anava House is.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's still sitting there on the internet.
We designed letterhead. It was
we had letterhead. It was it was really legit.
In Kansas City too, the Community of Communities has a Google group,
mm-hmm.
where we meet like once a quarter, mm-hmm. sort of whenever we can get everybody in the same room. But it's,
I just joined that, actually.
Yeah.
Somebody made me aware of it. I joined it. I'm planning on trying to send out an email through that.
That's a good
people
source.
Will get it. They do respond to the emails. Some communities better than others. Like, mm-hmm. more. Some communities are more plugged into sort of technology better than others.
Which is another thing that I've always lamented, was that, like, there aren't...
Like there's not like a network.
They don't have the... Maybe it's just that they don't have the time because they're so busy helping people or whatever, but I really wish that there were more tech-savvy people in intentional communities.
Yeah, and I mean, there are some. And usually there's at least one person in every community that will respond to an email,
uh-huh.
hopefully. But when was the last time we met was...
January, I believe.
So we're due for another one soon-ish.
Yeah.
So, but it's, I mean, when we gather, it's like, we'll have a potluck dinner. A different community hosts it every time. It wasn't January. It was like March, because the January was at Cherith Brook, and then there was another one after that at Oak Park that you weren't there for. I don't know where you were, but, so the, it goes from space to space, but, we'll have a potluck, and then someone will just propose a topic of conversation, and we'll talk about it. So, but it's, in Kansas City, it's really cool, because it brings together, like, both the Kansas and the Missouri side, and there's usually, there's a pretty good representation of almost every community. At least one or two people show up from each one, which is kind of cool. So there's that, and then there's, I mean, there's some of them are on Facebook. Oak Park is on Facebook, Cherith Brook is on Facebook, Holy Family House is on Facebook.
I'd really like to be able to connect you. I mean, I don't know how much time you have to do interviews like this, but I'd really like to connect you with my friend Mark in Liberty.
Right.
He used to live with us.
Part of our community.
He's 50-ish. One, maybe?
Uh-huh.
And 52. And he lived with us in Liberty, but he's a guy who has a lot of connections as well, but he spent a lot of time not necessarily living in intentional community, but fostering community in like places all over the U.S. Like he's worked with people in the South Texan border, in Haiti. He's done a lot of work with a little community in the mountains of Haiti. And in the Bahamas, and I think he's got a couple other projects in the work as well. But he's a fascinating guy to talk to. He has a lot of ideas about intentional community and the church and what the social function of communities in the church are supposed to be.
I'd love to talk to him.
Yeah, yeah, I'd have to. I'll send you his
email. He's up in Liberty.
Yeah, fascinating guy.
And if you're going to St. Louis, there's Lotus House.
Yeah.
And there's also we know
several Catholic worship houses.
Yeah. Oh yeah. There's two or three, at least, sort of on varying degrees of the scale.
Mm-hmm.
Karen House would be a really interesting one to talk to. They've been around forever, and they specifically work with single women with children, I think.
I don't know.
Is Karen House?
Yeah, I don't know how it's spelled.
I think it's K-A-R-E-N.
Is it like the name?
I think.
But it's been around for like 30 or something years, a long time. And it's so cool because the people, I don't know about too much about the people that started it, but the people that live there now are like the dumpster diving hippie type, and they're real fun. And it's just a really interesting mix of people. We went to a community of communities gathering in St. Louis once, and so we got to meet
kind of
all these
people. I've been there a couple of times.
Yeah. So there's, and then we also know, like, we have a friend, Alex, who's a PhD student at St. Louis University, who is a former member of Lotus House. So he lived there for a little while, left, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago.
There's a guy named Mark Van Steenwyck who helped found a community in the Twin Cities area in Minneapolis.
That's the Twin Cities.
Yeah. and he's written several books on, actually, he does a lot of work with like anarchism and anarchist activism. But they have this is kind of interesting to us, they have a community called the Mennonite Worker, which is sort of based on, it's a merging of the values of the Catholic worker movement and the Mennonites.
Anabaptist
tradition, which Alyssa and I are both Mennonites. I don't know if they claim us, but
I think they like us.
Yeah, maybe so.
But
they, and Mark has done a lot of really good work as well. He's done a lot of like social activism, but you wouldn't be able to travel there, but he's a really easy guy to talk to and connect with, like on Facebook. I've talked to him before.
We also, there's a couple that goes to our church that are former members of, is it Reba Place in Chicago?
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, they weren't members of Reba Place.
I thought they were. Yeah, no. Was
they,
it the...
They were involved with Reba Place in some way.
They didn't live there. I think there's like a larger church community, and maybe they...
Yeah. Reba Place is a Mennonite community.
Yeah.
Yeah. And...
David Jansen lives there, I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
Or he may be at Plow Creek.
There's a program through Mennonite USA called Mennonite Voluntary Service, mm-hmm. where usually, like, college-age people can participate in this program, and then they go and live in a city, sometimes far or near to where they're from, and they get basically a volunteer job at a local nonprofit, and they're supported by either their community or their church, but they live with other MBS participants while they do it, and our church is a sort of a host for a branch of that program in Kansas City.
Now would be a perfect time to contact them, because they have, in about a week or two...
Three of them are leaving.
All of the...
to go back to...
all of the MVSers from this past year, like, their year has ended, and they will all be leaving to go back home. So they will have, like, they all have a year of intentional living under their belt. So they would be, it would be fascinating to hear their perspectives on what it's like to live together.
It's a very specific type of communal living, though, where they basically get an allowance because they don't get paychecks from their job, but they do, they live together and cook together and all that stuff, so it would be interesting to hear their perspective. Right now we have, there's one guy from Lawrence, a girl from Indiana, a girl from Pennsylvania, and a guy from Germany, and so they're kind of a cool mix of people.
What's your church again?
Rainbow Mennonite. It's on Southwest Boulevard.
You could contact them and they would put you in touch. Their offices, they have regular office hours, so you could call the office and they could connect you with the MBS house.
There's a guy that is sort of like the director of our branch of it, and they probably, I can't remember, Eric something, I can't remember his last name.
You'd have to connect with them sometime in the next week or so, though, because they are...
Well, one of the girls is leaving in like 2 weeks, and then the rest of them are here through at least the end of July. Ben is here through the end of August, but... the two of them are going back at the end of next month. But they would be really interesting to talk to.
All right, I'll get in contact with them. That's cool. A good lead. Thank you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.